My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. In 1940, Thomas Wolfe's novel, You Can't Go Home Again, was published posthumously. The fictional storyline addresses the issue of our roots and whether we may return to them, physically and spiritually, and what we will find when we do. If we had the means of traveling back and reconnecting with generations past, what would we learn? How would their lives and their connection to the world they lived in, including their relationship with each other, nature, and spirituality, afford us an opportunity for reflection and renewal? Can we truly go home again? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Randy Kwiatkowski, lived this experience. He journeyed into the realm of his ancestral Native American connections and intimate encounters with Mother Earth, and says we all have the ability to spiritually reconnect with our ancestors and nature. Randy Kwiatkowski is an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. He's a founder of Ecologia, an international environmental organization that works on the planet's more extreme challenges, and formerly professor at Keystone College, research scholar at Middlebury College, and Erasmus Mundus scholar at the Central European University in Budapest and Lund University in Sweden. He lives in Vermont. His website is randykwiatkowski.com, and he joins me this week to discuss his new book, Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Way of Our Ancestors. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Randy Kwiatkowski. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you. I love your introduction.
Randy, please share with us a little bit about your early life and path.
Well, it turns out that that's one of the more challenging questions I've been asked, because I see an enormous discontinuity between my early life being the first 6 decades, and the recent events and awakening. As I reflect back on my early life, I see glimmerings here and there momentarily of the kinds of sensitivities and awareness that probably were always latent or dormant, but I just never let them emerge. I was not in a community, as my book says, without reservation, you know, outside of the reservation. I wasn't in a community that would have said, oh, hey, back up. Let's talk about what you just told me. Let's talk about that dream. Let's talk about that experience in the middle of the night, or that reaction to events. So I kind of missed the boat, unlike a lot of my relatives who grew up in households or on a reservation and were deeply, on a daily basis, surrounded by people who could help tease out and give permission to embrace the kinds of intimate contacts that I now have with ancestors and Mother Earth.
So in your youth, what was your impression of Native Americans?
Oh, I loved them. I used to get my cap pistol out, put that little roll of red paper in and my six shooter and go over in the rocks next to my house, which was just a few yards from where they dug up the Indian cemetery in my backyard. And I would shoot imaginary Indians. So that was my relationship with Indians. I knew that we had Indian ancestry, but it was of no particular consequence. I sat on the lap of my grandfather, who went to 3 of the now infamous Indian schools, spent his virtual childhood in these schools, but he never talked about the experience. He could not bring himself to utter a word about the experience. He could tell me about being gassed in World War I in the trenches, horrific experiences in the war, But evidently, and I now understand, the experience in the Indian schools, which was the U.S. government's effort to erase the memory and culture of Native Americans, did its job on him, and it was so painful that he did not want to pass along that experience.
How did you become aware, then, of your Native American heritage?
Well, I'm a historian. I was trained as a historian and a sociologist, and I read, and I've always been interested in minority affairs. So I came to an awareness of Native Americans through an academic, intellectual, historical, sociological route, which is awfully abstract. And then 3 or 4 years ago, events that in previous life would be once every 10 years began being once every few hours. And then, as I describe in the Awakening chapter, when my mother had a stroke and took up residence with us and was clearly dying, developments, I called them visitations, some of them were reflections and observations on things, began to happen almost every single night. I think I described, you know, we sleep on a screened-in porch 6 months a year here in Vermont, and things like a firefly would awaken me in the middle of the night. Now, for those of you who don't live where there are fireflies, they're the most miraculous flying insects, and they have these blinking green lights, and some years the sky is full of them like stars, and other years there are a few. The year my mother died, when she was with us, the fireflies came extraordinarily early. And I would hear, it's hard to explain to some people, but it's like synesthesia. I would hear the blinking light in the middle of the night, and I would wake up, and there would be a giant firefly on the screen. Basically, I felt saying, "Randy, wake up. We have something to tell you." And then as I awoke, I would hear coy wolf, which is another chapter in my book, you know, a hybrid coyote wolf, or I would hear the owl. We have a barred owl, and the bird books say the barred owl calls with "Who cooks for you?" You know, "Hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo." In Potawatomi, the name is "Cuckoo-o-coo." So these creatures, these wonderful kin, would greet me, and I got to the point where I would get up and I would talk back to "Cuckoo-o-coo," and I just became much, much more entangled with that dimension of living. And that's when I had to consult elders and family members who are knowledgeable on such things. And they began to be my, I guess you would say, spirit guides, saying, "Randy, what's happening is absolutely normal. When someone is dying, the owl comes to show them how to walk home." And I became inquisitive. I became curious. And it was perplexing. There are times it was frightening. But it felt like a gift, and I wanted to embrace it, and I did. So that's the recent history, and that's when I began writing the book, just to clarify it in my own mind.
Your story contains so many wonderful synchronicities. When we experience what Jung referred to as meaningful coincidences with no causal connection, we have the choice of either resonating with them and following the path or disregarding them. How did you make your choices?
Well, the university-trained, rational, scientific side of me was always asking. The immediate response was always, "Okay, Kritikowski, don't. You know, be self-aggrandizing, don't overreact to this. You know, the hypothesis on the table always has to be, this is a coincidence." So it got to the point where I tested myself, in addition to consulting with elders. And I think in the book, there's a chapter, "Cuckoo-o-coo Returns," or some such thing. And one night after the temperature hit well below zero up here, I awoke in the middle of the night, as I often do. That's when these visitations occur. Put on my warmest clothing, went out for a walk, looking for "Cuckoo-o-coo," had been active, and had an enormously long conversation. It was a full moonlit night, which is another one of those things that seems to inspire visitations. And after having a lengthy conversation, suddenly the rational side of my brain kicked in, And I said to myself, I didn't say it out loud, okay, Krakowski, Moonlit Night, mice are out, owls eat mice. Of course the owl would be out and be active tonight. And I said to myself, okay, show me something less probable than the coincidence of a owl on a moonlit night. And I looked up at the sky, and the relatively cloudy sky in the west suddenly opened, and the most astounding shooting star scribbled itself slowly across the firmament. It wasn't one of those snap your fingers microsecond little meteorites of the summer. This was the longest shooting star I'd ever experienced. And I felt that that was a message from my ancestors saying, Krakowski, how many times do we have to tell you, apropos of the Jung quote, how many times do we have to tell you this is for real? This isn't a coincidence. It was quite a humbling experience and beautiful.
Please tell us about the significance of Kukukuku, the owl's call you heard after your mother passed. What's the significance of that?
Well, I had once in my college days seen a film about, it was called, you know, The Owl Called My Name. It was an anthropologist living in the Northwest, and, you know, just horrible fear overtakes him when he hears the owl call his name, and he consults with a tribal elder, and they say, well, when the owl calls your name, he's calling you home, and death is near. So the night before my mother had her second, fatal stroke, we got out of the car after hearing a presentation on Native ancestry, and the owl must have been just a few feet from the car, which is most unusual. And it was a hugely loud call. And that's when I wrote to my cousin Barb, she was quoted extensively in the book. And I said, oh my God, you know, I'm afraid my mother's going to die. And she said, don't be afraid. Owl is there as a guide as your mother walks on. You know, this is the way it works in our tribal culture. And I found it enormously comforting. I mean, I knew she was dying. She knew she was dying. And basically the ancestors and whatever consciousness there is that's out there was basically saying, hey, this is part of the cycle. It's okay. And I had already grown accustomed to the idea that her passing was going to be a tragic loss. But as I say in the book, and as my cousin's name from my mother indicates, she was already opening the door and showing us something that we had neglected our whole life. So Kukuoku was the messenger of the meaning of death, the role of death, and what lies beyond.
And you said it means who cooks for you, and who cooks for you but your mother.
Exactly. Isn't that a lovely synchronicity?
What a wonderful, wonderful message. You know, I identified with your sharing of your mom's transition and the tradition of the North Star, which your cousin Barb explained to you, because I lost my mom in January, and I really identify with that. Would you share this with our listeners, the nature of that spiritual name and what it means?
Well, Native Americans are given spirit names. Some tribes and some individuals keep them quite secretive. They're private. And the reason is that the belief and tradition is that the creator, Gichi Manitou in our tribal language, really only recognizes you when you have a name, and recognizes you by your spirit name. So I was deeply concerned as my mother lay dying, realizing, oh my God, you know, my grandson had a naming ceremony and my mother had been there and we had never even discussed giving her a name. What have we done? And the same with my grandfather. We don't think he ever had an Indian name. So my cousin did what she often does. You know, she smoked her pipe and meditated for quite some time, and the name came to her. And it's, again, for people who are outside of our traditions or haven't had these experiences, it's hard to explain a visitation. But some people seek them aggressively. For Native Americans, more often, you open the door and you wait. So, you know, my cousin was waiting for the name to come, and it came. And the name that came to her was She Who Shows You the Way, which was just absolutely perfect because that's what my mother was doing. And it was profoundly comforting, profoundly.
It really was a message, wasn't it, from your mother's spirit?
Yes.
Something that brought you comfort at a time when you were concerned about the fact that there was no closure with that name.
Exactly.
What a gift. What a beautiful, beautiful gift. And I'm sure you're grateful to your cousin Barb for doing that.
Yes, yes. And my mother's spirit is still about on occasion. Some people use the word ghosts. I'm a little uncomfortable with it because of its association with Victorian novels and people wearing white sheets and going, whoo, whoo, whoo. But I occasionally feel her presence, not a troubling presence, and she's not troubled. But again, just to follow this train of thought, an Abenaki, that's the indigenous tribe in Vermont, chief recently gave me in the springtime some seeds of crops that they grew in their culture. And I decided, you know, that we would plant them on the day of my mother's third anniversary of her death in our garden this year. And we planted them on June 14th. And I looked around and I saw some oxeye daisies. They're the beautiful little white daisies with a yellow center. I cut the bouquet because I had always given her these flowers on her birthday since childhood. I would drive to Binghamton to give them to her on her birthday. She didn't care about getting some expensive gift. She wanted the daisies. So I put them in a vase. We planted the seeds. And then the worst hot spell came, you know, 90 degree plus temperatures every day. And, you know, they wilted quite quickly in the vase. I went out one morning and poured in some water and they stood back up. I thought, whoa, this is amazing. These are resilient flowers. And then I forgot about them for a few days and they were wilted again. I went out, poured some more water in the vase and they stood back up. And I commented to my wife, you know, we pick these and bring them inside out of the sunshine and they usually last 3 or 4 days and they wilt. What's going on here? Well, I'll be darned. The daisies lasted for 24 days in the hot sun to the day of my birthday, and then they expired. And it was as if my mother, you know, were giving me back the daisies that I gave her on her birthday, and she kept them alive till my birthday. It was profoundly comforting.
I will share with you a personal story that you will appreciate. As I had mentioned, my mom passed in January, and after the funeral, there were about 20 of us who went out to have something to eat. And we went to a restaurant, and we each ordered our respective beverage, whatever that might have been. And the server came and gave everyone their beverage. A few minutes later, she showed up, and she said, "Who ordered the Coke?" My mother, as I explained in my eulogy, kept cases of Coca-Cola in the house at all times. She loved Coca-Cola, good, bad, or indifferent, whatever people think, she kept cases of it. And that was her way of letting us know that she was with us at that gathering after her funeral. So I think you'd appreciate that story.
It's wonderful. And isn't it sad that many people would never make the connection, or if they did, they would be embarrassed to mention it and to embrace it?
Absolutely. I think we need to listen more to the messages of spirit in whichever way they manifest or come to us, because therein lies the wisdom, therein lies the proof, and therein lies the love.
Yes.
My guest is Randy Kratkowski. He's the author of Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and this wonderful story.
Well, my book can be found in the, you know, usual online places. You know, independent booksellers have it, Amazon, the Simon & Schuster website, Barnes & Noble. Even in this day of a crisis of printing houses in the publishing industry, it does seem to be available, at least at the beginning here. And my personal website, where I provide some information on my background and why I wrote the book, is just randykratkowski.com. My name is a bit of a mouthful, but it's KRITKAUSKY.
Randy, we'll be back with more of your story after these words on the Olden Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. Olden Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hi, this is David Strickle. I'm excited to share my brand new show, The Stream of David Live, right here on OM Times Radio. Each week, I'll have exciting guests, and I'll channel the eternal wisdom of The Stream, a group of non-physical entities whose teachings have transformed lives all over the world. So join us for an uplifting hour each Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. That's The Stream of David Live, right here on OM Times Radio.
When you wake up in the morning, are you excited for the new day? Are you passionate about your work? Are your relationships fulfilling? And finally, are you happy? I'm Mia Voce, your host and guide to the power of five. Harness the forces of the universe and unleash your powers within. Join me each Tuesday, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on OM Times Radio. And remember, anything is possible. You only just have to believe.
A social distancing tip.
Keeping your distance from others is important in slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are some fun things to do alone. Read a book, take a walk, unpack your suitcase from that trip you took last September, paint a self-portrait, catch up on a TV series, do a puzzle. Remember, we should all stay home to lower the risk for everyone. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part. Because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, it's time for today's STEM tip. Want to know how to make your selfies even better? Okay, let's use science. The best time for photos is golden hour. That's the moment right before the sun sets, when the atmosphere scatters blue and violet wavelengths, making perfect, soft, and golden selfie light to show off that beautiful face of yours. Click. Check out Chic and STEM for more inspiration. A message from the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Randy Kritkowski. He's the author of Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, there are many stereotypes and assumptions about what it means to be an American Indian. You don't easily fit into any of those categories. Where do you see yourself fitting in?
Well, we'll begin with the word see, because as you know, the opening paragraph of my book is Mirror, Mirror on the Wall. Am I a real Indian after all?
Absolutely. That was funny.
And I look in the mirror, and what looks back at me, as I said, you know, this light brown hair, you know, hazel eyes, Northern European features person who looks nothing like those Italian actors who used to pretend to be and created our stereotype of what an Indian ought to look like. So there is immediately, you know, for I think all of us in this time in particular, this question of how are we judged and how do we judge ourselves based on, you know, racialized identity? And should that even be the basis by which we aggregate people and treat them differently? Or should it be something, you know, on the inside, you know, the spiritual state? And I clearly come down on the latter, you know, that it's what's, you know, in our hearts and our spirit, and to a considerable degree in our intellect that makes us something or not something. That said, I do want to recognize, and I'm very clear from the first pages of my book, to say I am an Indian without reservation. it's a pun, of course. I'm not hesitating to embrace what happened. That's the without reservation. But I never grew up on a reservation. I do not have that experience on a daily basis of being surrounded by people on the reservation. I cannot speak for those people, but demographically, statistically, the majority of people who are legally enrolled tribal members in the United States do not live on reservations. You know, they've been mainstreamed partly by policies of the U.S. government and partly just by the natural process of assimilation that happens when a culture conquers and colonizes another. You know, the subject population intermarries and the blood lines get diluted.
And what do you see when you've visited reservations?
Well, I've only been to a few. I drove through some in the Southwest, and you know, they were arid. You know, the impression of poverty is overwhelming. I did not spend enough time on them to get a sense of the social and cultural characteristics of those reservations. I live part-time pre-COVID in Montreal, right across the river, St. Lawrence River, from the Kanawaga Mohawk Reservation. I have spent an immense amount of time there researching one of the chapters in the book on St. Kateri Tekakwitha. And I found that reservation to be comforting, in part because the people there are very, very proud. They're reasonably prosperous. You know, it doesn't have this overwhelming impression of poverty like we see on some reservations in the United States. And then, probably most importantly, I visited the Pokagon Reservation, which is a Potawatomi reservation in Michigan, literally the stomping ground of my ancestors. And I was really nervous because I knew I was going to be physically identifiable as the person, you know, who doesn't really look like an Indian. But I was at home from the first meal in the morning when they served us indigenous food. And since I've developed food allergies to everything related to gluten and dairy, there was a smorgasbord of wild edibles from the woods that my ancestors ate, and I could eat it all. And I suddenly realized that part of my awakening had been profoundly physiological, not just spiritual. My body was basically saying, Randy, you can't eat that stuff. It isn't our ancestral food. So for breakfast now, I have wild rice porridge with dried cranberries and nuts, and I feel great. But eat a bowl full of, you know, Wheaties or some other wheat-based cereal with milk on it, and I'm sick for the day.
It's important to remember our natural connection, isn't it?
Oh, our bodies remember. Even when the spirit forgets, they remind us.
Who were and who currently are the Potawatomi?
The Potawatomi were an upper Midwest woodlands tribe, one of many of the Council of Three Fires around Chicago, Wisconsin, Illinois. The others were the Ojibwe and the Odawa. And we literally populated the Chicago waterfront. There's a statue of one of our chiefs there. And in fact, the name Chicago comes from a Potawatomi word for wild garlic. And in the 1830s, under incredible duress and intimidation, we signed a treaty saying that we would negotiate away our rights to that land. And then we were forced at gunpoint as the Cherokee on something called, you know, the March of Death to Kansas, where many of the tribe members spent a few decades. And then we were once again uprooted and moved on to Shawnee, Oklahoma, to the desert. So within a generation or a generation and a half, we went from being a woodlands people to a people living in the desert. And that's where our particular tribe branch is located. One branch of the tribe succeeded in staying on the Pokagon Reservation. Some fled into Canada. Some are currently in Kansas, but we've been scattered to the winds.
You had mentioned the Ojibwe. I'm aware through alternative healing many years ago that a Canadian nurse by the name of Renee Cassia had learned from the Ojibwe about a formula that actually can be effective against certain types of cancer. Natural cures, that's really important, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. That's the only medicine that indigenous people had for millennium. And we're just now rediscovering that many of those natural medicines can do things that our pharmaceuticals cannot.
And not to mention the fact that our relationship, our respect for the earth, and in particular for the forests and the trees and their roots, is so important, because deforestation has led to the release of microbes that have been buried for millions of years.
Yes, it is a storehouse of knowledge and wealth that should not be underestimated.
I don't know the actual source or origin of COVID, but I would assume that it possibly had come from deforestation.
There's suggestion that if you don't look just at COVID, but if you look at swine flu and Zika and Ebola, that the common thread connecting them is transfer from wildlife to human beings. Now, it's a complicated genetic sequence that gets something that, you know, infects a bat in the wild to something that can infect a human. But as our population increases and as we move more and more into the wilderness, it brings us more and more in proximity to those diseases. And I think we're going to have to get used to dealing with this kind of thing. And as I wrote in one of the final chapters of my book, one of the great lessons of COVID for me, which hit during the same week that Lyme disease hit me, is that we need to be profoundly respectful of these little tiny microbes. They were here many tens of millions, if not billions of years before we were, and we're not having much luck outsmarting them.
Absolutely, and that calls for our respect of all of creation, because by disrespecting creation, we have created so many horrible problems. And we'll talk more about ecology and your work later on in the show. Getting back to the Potawatomi, please share the proper word of greeting when meeting another member of the tribe.
Well, the word, as one of the earliest chapters discusses, is widely understood to be bozho. It's B-O-Z-H-O, and the Ojibwe add an extra O. They have more syllables in their similar language, so it comes out bozho. The understanding was that this was part of a longer phrase of, you know, are you one of our ancestor tricksters who went away and said he would return? So the long version of the phrase, which I won't attempt in Potawatomi right now, basically comes out as, you know, bozho, blah, 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 blah. Are you this ancestor trickster coming back? And I tried, as my rational side of my brain and my historical researching proclivities direct me, I tried to track down, you know, the linguistic origins of that. And what I found out was that, like so many things in Native culture, you know, the origins are gone. It was an oral culture, and there's conflicting evidence. Some people suggest that bozho actually came from a corruption of bonjour for the French-Canadian fur trappers. And I ended up concluding that it doesn't really matter whether it was a corruption of the French term, an ancient greeting of indigenous people, or some kind of hybrid. The fact of the matter is that now it is recognized as a greeting of courtesy and respect. So I, once again, spent who knows how many weeks coming to a really simple conclusion, which is, what matters isn't where things came from, it's the respect that we give them and the respect with which we use those words and phrases.
Let's talk about that respect. What do people, indigenous people of this continent, like to be called or referred to? Because obviously they're not Indians, because that was a misnomer because of the explorers who thought they had landed at India. What do they like to be called?
Yeah, I personally am comfortable with Indian. Lots of Native Americans are. In the United States, I think there's a growing sensitivity, especially in literally the last few months, because of the appropriation of our names and images. I think there's a growing sensitivity to the use of the word Indian. And I would say being called Native American is generally more comfortable than Indigenous person is also, you know, relatively safe. In Canada, they use the term First Nations. And the answer to your question, if you ask someone, you know, who lives on a reservation, would be, oh, call us by our nation's name, because after all, we are not lumped together as some kind of homogenous Native population or Indigenous population. That's another one of the misconceptions. It would be like Native Americans discovering Europe and coming back and saying, oh, we discovered Europeans in the 16th century, and the Germans would be jumping up and down protesting. They wouldn't want to be mixed in with the English and the French and the Dutch and the Austrians and the Spanish. So the most respectful thing you can do is just ask a Native American, and what do you like to be called? How do you like to be addressed? And then you're in for a little bit of education and probably a little history lesson.
And I think that's important. I think it's important that we understand that history and that we embrace it and understand what these folks went through.
The Canadians have a term. It's been institutionalized and legalized. It's called Truth and Reconciliation. They actually had a commission on it. And they are well down the path, decades ahead of us, trying to engage in a national effort through their schools and their national broadcast networks of giving a high profile to First Nations people. I mean, when I log on to the CBC, that's their public broadcast network website, it's impossible to look at the news for the day and not see two stories about Indigenous affairs, usually written by Indigenous people. If I look at the equivalent of major media in the United States, I can go weeks without seeing a single story on Native Americans, and almost never written by Native Americans.
You briefly touched upon this in the first segment. How did you come up with that title? It has a deeper meaning than just being not from the reservation, without reservation.
Yes. It struck me. I'm in love with puns, as my family will groaningly tell you. And as I was wrestling with the term and I wrote it down, the first thing that hit me was the dual meaning. And the one meaning, of course, is not having any reservation about these visitations and awakenings that were coming my way, even when they were disorienting, perplexing, and, as I said, occasionally frightening. And that gets back to an earlier part of our conversation, which is if we hesitate, you know, if we engage the spiritual world with severe reservations, we're gating or putting up barriers and obstacles. And I had to make a decision early on in this journey to risk engaging in this pathway with as little reservation as I dared. And I still reflect, I still interrogate myself intellectually, but that doesn't mean that I don't simultaneously embrace, you know, these spiritual awakenings.
His name is Randy Kretkowski. His book is called Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. We'll be back with more of Randy after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
A social distancing tip.
Putting distance between yourself and others is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are ways to stay in contact without the physical contact part. Call, send a text, set up a video conference, post on social media, dedicate a song on the radio. If you have symptoms of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, call your healthcare provider before going to their office. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Randy Kratkowski. He's the author of Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, surprisingly little is written about the spiritual life of Native Americans in the 21st century. But that is where your book starts, digs in deeply, and ends. What did this dimension of being Native American touch you?
Where do I begin? I'm a little bit like a child. I've always enjoyed being around children because, you know, they have the willingness to be naive and be surprised and also, you know, say, oh, wow, and ask what we call the stupid question of how does that work and what does it mean? So I'm trying to engage my Native American awakening in that spirit. I don't know if I'm answering your question directly.
I believe so. I think you're touching upon that. And then the spiritual encounters and synchronicities have added to that.
Absolutely. They're woven together. I think I used the term spiral in my book at least 50 times. And I think this notion of synchronicities draws upon that image. And in my short path of awakening, events keep reconnecting with one another in the most astounding ways that defy our understanding of time as this linear progression where the past is gone, never to reappear. So I'm continually looping back on previous experience.
You talked before about Coy Wolf. You share a powerful reconnection with kin in your telling of your experience with Coy Wolf. Here in our little urban backyard, I have daily encounters with squirrels and jays who have befriended me. What may we learn from our four-legged and winged kin?
As much as we have the time and patience to learn, there are many, many different ways we learn. I mean, one is anyone, even those who are spiritually gated, can learn by observing. you know, anyone who's growing a garden right now, and everyone seems to be locked down growing a garden, is learning an awful lot about the difficulties of growing corn and squash and various plants together. You don't have to have a spiritual connection with them to be learning by observation. The next level of engagement with these plants and animals is when you develop a reciprocal relationship with them, and you plant them with respect, which for me and my native kin means making an offering of ceremonial tobacco when the seed is put in the ground. And when you harvest, you do that also with respect and offer tobacco. And very often leave something behind. So if you're harvesting berries, you leave some behind for those squirrels and chipmunks and bear. But that's a different level of engagement. And that's when, as you know, some books have popularized, you feel as if, you know, the plants and the trees are talking to you. Now people have made jokes, very, very uncharitable jokes about that, you know, such as, so they speak English or French? You know, or do you understand tree? You know, it's not, of course, that direct kind of communication. It's the kind of communication that trees and plants have one another through these mycorrhizal networks, which are some of the most massive communication systems on Earth, of tiny little fibers underground. And, you know, they've been evolving for tens or hundreds of millions of years, various methods of telling one another there's a predator in the woods, so that one tree is bitten by the predator and the other trees start emitting toxins to keep the predator away. It's reasonable to assume that these new arrivals, the two-legged humans, were probably noticed by the trees, and they have probably in their own ways made their efforts to find ways of communicating to us and with us. And some of us, I know, feel that very, very strongly. Who will go into the forest when we're gathering sap and touch a tree and say, well, this one's willing and able, and this one not?
You touched upon Gichi Manitou before, meaning the creator spirit. Does everything in creation have a Manitou?
Yes. I mean, everything in creation, as I understand most, I should say the Native American cultures that I am reasonably well acquainted with, and that's actually a very small subset of all of them, believe that, you know, the creator, creators, singular plural is almost irrelevant here, were made, you know, in the same spirit and made interconnected, and the danger and the harm comes when some part of that creation breaks the connections and the links and fails to continue to interact with other parts of creation in a reciprocal, supportive manner. So in a sense, you know, harming the trees needlessly, harming the animals needlessly, is inflicting harm on the collective we. That doesn't mean that you don't take a life, if you want to view a carrot as a life, or a deer or an elk. You just do it with gratitude, asking for permission, understanding that it, that is the creation, will do the same and occasionally view you as the prey, as you are now the predator. And I think that's one of the things we're learning from COVID. We are not always the highest predator on the food chain. Sometimes we're at the bottom.
Sometimes we eat and sometimes we're eaten.
Exactly.
Is your story one of spiritual awakening or spiritual reawakening and therefore remembering?
Ah, this is the one I'm wrestling with. And again, this journey is not over, and I probably won't answer all these questions, even if I live another two decades. To some degree, I do have this hypothesis, if you'll pardon me for intellectualizing for a moment, that part of what's happening is some kind of, you know, genetically imprinted ancestral memory bubbling up. And I say that because many Native Americans who are off reservation have these stories, which they usually break down into tears while they're telling me of doing something like going to a basket making class because they want to learn to make baskets. And the teacher comes over and says, "Oh, I see you're an expert basket maker. You know, how long have you been doing this?" And the person will say, "It's my first one, but it's just coming back to me as if I knew." And I have met, you know, young Native Americans who, in their earliest verbalizations, come out with questions and statements that you would expect to come out of a Native American elder or, you know, a Buddhist monk who has lived, you know, in quiet isolation for a very, very long lifetime. This can only be the case if somehow something is imprinted in our DNA, kind of like monarchs. You know, they go away and five generations later, you know, some of them come back home. They don't have GPS systems. They don't have written records. Somehow something is written into their DNA and RNA. And if those tiny little creatures have it, I suspect that we do.
How may those of us who do not have indigenous roots follow your example and reconnect with ours and with nature? What are, as you refer to them in your book, the pathways to knowing?
Thank you for asking the question in that sequence. That is perfect. I mean, it's almost we choreographed it. One of the things that I fear is romanticizing and mystifying Native Americans, especially in these desperate spiritual times, literally right now when people are looking for something to cling to. And I don't like putting Indians on a pedestal. I think because some of us, and I would like to think maybe I'm at least have a half a foot in that class, able to articulate what is unique to our experience, because we're able to do that, that becomes a kind of Native American exceptionalism. And then other people say, I can't do that. I don't need to try. You know, I don't have those genes. I don't have that heritage. Well, you know, part of my experience, and I make it very clear in the book, is awakening to the experience and connections to my French Canadian five generations ago fur trapper voyageur ancestor in Montreal, who literally called me home to his stomping ground. And I feel like he was sitting in the theater when I watched the story about my grandfather's schooling. So I think we all have the ability to reconnect to our ancestors. And as a Catholic deacon church friend of mine said, and I love this quote, he said, "You know, I think God or the Creator speaks to each of us in our own vernacular, and we need to learn to listen to it." So the vernacular of Native Americans may be unique to Native Americans. And part of what I'm describing and some of the words and terms I use may be unique to Native Americans. But that doesn't mean that French and Germans and, you know, Swahili and Chinese don't have the same kinds of experiences. I know they do from talking to them.
You also share seven grandmother-grandfather teachings. Please share them with us.
They are written on the stones behind me. I'm going to reach for the dish because a friend of mine painted them, and her habit is to start the day by turning over a stone blindly and seeing what the teaching for the day is. So I'm going to turn them over. You may hear the clinking. One of them is humility, which I write about a great deal in the book, and I think that's the lesson of COVID. Another one is respect. One is wisdom. Another is truth, trust, love, and bravery. I struggle in the book with some of the definitions of some Native Americans concerning bravery. That's a whole chapter on what Jim Thorpe taught me. And I've added an extra stone since these are the grandfather's and grandmother's teachings, and I'm a grandfather. I wrote on the back of my additional stone, reconciliation. Mm. Because I believe, apropos of what the Canadians are doing, that we need to reconcile ourselves first and then collectively, you know, our groups and society to one another and find out what the truth of the past is and then make peace with ourselves and one another. And when I made that stone, I had no idea how our society was going to erupt and how much this concept of reconciliation would move to the forefront.
Absolutely. His name is Randy Kritkowski. His book is Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out about your wonderful work.
Yes, most of the well-known major book outlets, independent bookstores, my publisher, Inner Traditions. I actually list them on my website and have links. And that website is randykritkowski.com. Randy is R-A-N-D-Y, and then continuing, K-R-I-T-K-A-U-S-K-Y.
Randy, thank you for joining us and sharing this amazing story and your wonderful wisdom.
Well, I thank you for the invitation.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.